Well, now that we've seen something about both the political changes in the European balance of power with the rise of Russia and Prussia, something with the ideology and its problems in the Enlightenment, we must now come to the social and economic structure of the 18th century just prior to the French Revolution. So what then can we say about the social and economic structure just prior to the French Revolution? Let us start with the most constant element and the element most beloved by some of you. Let us start with the peasant in the unchanging countryside. Now, the peasant was a conservative element in society. The revolutions in industry and politics in the 18th century were exclusively of urban origins. Indeed, there was the saying in the French countryside that in Paris they make nothing but revolutions. And it is a fact that during the French Revolution, the countryside remained for the most part monarchist and even had monarchist anti-revolutionary uprising. The technique of agriculture was still medieval as well. It was still, as it had been in the Middle Ages, the open field system, small and scattered plots. A peasant probably took up to half of his time just walking from one of his plots to the other. The main object of the peasant was what we would call subsistence farming. That is, farming to nourish himself. He would only have a few cash crops to pay taxes and to get money for a very few necessities, largely clothing, which he no longer made at home. Moreover, over the villages, the nobles and clergy still exercise a semi-feudal authority, though we get greater and greater absentee landlords as well. In spite of what we know about the enclosures, there was still a lot of cooperation within the peasant village. You have the common land for grazing and that sort of thing, in spite of the enclosure movement. But trouble was already brewing. In heavily populated areas like France, like the Rhine Valley or the Po Valley in Italy, there wasn't enough land for subsistence farming. The peasants came to be what we call land poor. Thus, many peasants in the 18th century became sharecroppers. Sharecroppers for urban people, for more and more rich urbanites invested in land. Or if he didn't become a sharecropper for urbanites, he practiced village industry, that is to say largely the spinning wheel, to supplement his wages. Many of them eventually moved into towns and became industrial workers. This had already happened in the 17th and 18th century. For by and large, land became ever more valuable, not less valuable. And that is why so many of the urban classes invested in land. It became, in the 18th century, the best form of investment, the best form of social security. Because of the great monetary speculation, which you will read about, it became a good form of investment. Moreover, by the 18th century, the countryside had been made safe. That is to say, the centralized monarchy had waged a rather successful war against the highwaymen. And so more and more rich urbanites began to have estates in the country, to found landed estates, to have a country house, the importance of which I shall come back a little later. The countryside was becoming safe for travel then. The danger from highwaymen had lessened, and it became extremely fashionable to have a place in the country. What about the city itself? Here, one major architectural change reflects the Enlightenment in another way. Those cities which were built in the 18th century, even somewhat before, the church or the cathedral is no longer in the central position. For example, in the German city of Mannheim, an 18th century city, which you can still see, I suppose, dreary place. Well, in the German city of Mannheim, built in 1662, the center of the city is a square, and the church is not really distinguished from the town hall. Both are one corner of the square, but the city is no longer centered on the church or, in fact, on the town hall. City planning was becoming more and more rational in the sense that the emphasis was upon the whole city. The center of a city, if it was the center of a territory, was the palace of the absolute monarch or of the prince who ruled it. This was always now the focus for the straight streets which ran to the center. You can see that in another German city, if you get to Germany, built in the 18th century, Karlsruhe, the capital of what was then the Grand Duchy of Baden, which is done this way. And an 18th century description will make it still clearer. The tower of the palace is the center of the circle around which the town is built. The town is a star whose streets are drawn to focus on the palace tower, so that every citizen of Karlsruhe, when he opens his shop in the morning, only has to turn around his head to see the father of his country, symbolized by the palace tower at the end of the street. There you have it in stone and mortar, the reflection of the age of absolutism and of the age of the Enlightenment. The old centers, the church and the town hall, are replaced by the new centers, the palace of the ruler, or in fact, if there was none, by no center at all. The center is a square. Within the town, we have many kinds of variations, obviously, as I told you once before. The population was divided into rigid marked classes. Status was all important still, and expressed itself in dress as well. Everything there depended upon birth, which led to an occupation. On the top was still the patriciate, as I told you a great long time before, the families who had ruled the town for a century, who held the leading position in city government, who were, in fact, a kind of nobility by birth. Then still came the members of the chief trading guilds of the city, the wholesale merchants, in a commercial society, actually the richest citizens, but not the patriciate. They often weren't the richest, necessarily. The wholesale merchants were. Then in the third place, still the lawyers and artists and retailers, and in the last place, the handicraftsmen, the little shops, and outside any scale, the laborers and servants. Indeed, the biggest class in any major European city in the 18th century would be the servant class. For example, we have the figures of London, and in London in the 18th century, of a population of what I would say is now about 3 million, there were 121,000 domestic servants. So that the domestic servants actually are in the town the largest class, which is sort of outside or beyond the kind of class structure. The same you can do for any other kind of town. It were the first two orders who dominated and ran the city. The economics were controlled through the guilds, which became, in fact, as I told you before, trade protective associations, and usually a barrier to the new industrial enterprises which had to be overcome. Their main object in the 18th century was to keep out aliens, in a way. And yet, this was breaking down, and careers in commerce were becoming more and more open to talent. Now, our problem is that we know very little about social mobility in the 18th century. We only know certain telltale examples that social mobility was indeed possible. For example, the grandfather of the poet Goethe was a journeyman tailor. His son, that is Goethe's father, was already an imperial counselor, as Goethe was himself. We find something that is still more telling, that commercial professions were getting greater and greater respectability. In 1800, for example, in the German city of Weimar, we find someone giving up a position of counselor to go into business, something quite unheard of in this caste society, but leading to the thought that this was getting at least somewhat more respectable. In other words, no society is ever as static as it appears, obviously. And obviously on that static society there were great pressures, such as the pressures of the new captains of industry. And the old patriciate was driven into a corner, but things change very slowly. In many towns this did not happen until the late 19th century. If you've ever read Thomas Mann's greatest novel, The Buddenbrooks, it is, in fact, plays around 1900, and in around 1900 you still have this great struggle between the new rich and the patriciate. That is a very, very slow change in a reality. The caste society, however, tried to enforce its own caste structure through regulations of dress, above all, in our period. And these regulations of dress play into the mercantilist aversion for expensive imports. Thus, for example, in 1706, Prussia regulated that craftsmen should not imitate the upper classes and deck out their women with pearls and silks. Pearls and silks are not for craftsmen, forbidden for craftsmen, but only for the upper classes. The next year, a similar kind of rule had to be adopted for domestics. In other words, these differences were kept, and they were the more serious as luxury was growing throughout the century. Luxury both because there was more money and more riches, but also because the countryside and the cities were safer. You didn't have to build palaces anymore for protection, like, let us, if you know, the Florentine palaces of the Renaissance. Pretty small within, because they were built like fortresses for protection. You didn't have to have places in the country which were fortresses. From the 17th and 18th century, as it were, both townhouses and country houses are no longer built for defense. And that meant a much greater luxury. You could have more rooms to live in. You gained a great deal of space. You could have windows where you could have none before. So that you begin a quite different, to use one of your favorite words, lifestyle. One of the most revolting words comes actually from fascism. Never mind. They were always concerned with the lifestyle. So they had a quite different kind of luxury, therefore, a quite different kind of lifestyle. So that you must now begin to envisage Europe as you envisage today Latin America. That is a great gulf between riches and poverty, a great gulf between luxury and slums. This begins already, in a way, before the Industrial Revolution. We must remember that most of the population did not go to school. In fact, you must remember, and I wish you keep it in mind, that compulsory primary education had to wait until the 1880s, another 100 years, until you have what you call compulsory primary education. And again here, the Enlightenment didn't really make a breakdown. Most of the population which lived in relative poverty, was, as we would have said, illiterate, at best self-taught, and there was a great deal of this self-teaching. The difference between wealth and poverty would have been startling. Remember that there was charity, but charity was a parish or church matter. There were little government provisions for charity. Charity was a parish matter ever since the Reformation, but the parish tax was kept as small as possible. And indeed, remember that poverty was regarded as a moral failing. Therefore, what you have in the 18th century were poor houses. I talked to you once before about that. Poor houses where the poor were put to work. Poor houses which were rather the way Dickens, you've all read Dickens maybe, Dickens described them in the 19th century. Don't always be so amused when I assume some cultural reading. Now, what you have therefore is, you haven't read the Buddenbrooks either, I bet. That is, I would say, a tragedy for you. Now, what you have, therefore, is no real government provisions. You have some government supervision. This is quite clear. But there is this great division between poverty on the one hand and riches. What about the nobility? I haven't said much about it. They are and will remain, very briefly, on top of the social structure. Except, let me remind you, for Prussia and England, they were politically disenfranchised to a certain extent. But in France, in the 18th century, the nobility staged a comeback, as you will read in Lefebvre, and a very important comeback indeed. For the comeback of the nobility in France squeezed the bourgeoisie, cut off advancement for the bourgeoisie, and is definitely one of the things which will play into the French Revolution in the end. However that may be, though the French nobility made a comeback, only in Prussia, I think, was the nobility harnessed to public service in a most meaningful and important way. In England as well, largely because of the peculiarity of the English class structure, where, as you may remember, you cannot make the sharp division between middle class and nobility that you have in France, that you have in Prussia, that you have virtually throughout Europe, because in England the nobility was closely tied to the middle classes, even in their commercial ventures, certainly in Parliament, to which I shall come in a minute. The higher clergy, that is your bishops and archbishops, belonged with the nobility. Your lower clergy was very poorly off indeed. The church was integrated into this class struggle. On the whole, politics varied, of course, from place to place, but we must say this about it. The nobility in France, as I said, staged a comeback and became extremely important for the decades before the French Revolution in the weak monarchy. In the weak monarchy. In Prussia, you know what the nobility did. But in England, we have a kind of special situation. For in England, the nobility and the upper middle classes, in a way, dominated Parliament. Indeed, English politics in the 18th century must be analyzed in terms of noble cliques. And when I say noble cliques, it is the nobility and their clients. And the clients were, as often as not, middle-class merchants. But it was the nobility which in the 18th century dominated them. In England, we have in the 18th century this peculiar situation after the English Revolution, which we call country house politics. For the politics were made in the country houses of the big English nobility, the Duke of Newcastle, the Grenvilles, the country houses, between cliques rather than in Parliament, to such an extent that they had to have a go-between these noble factions And the go-between came to be the ambassador of Sardinia. And when the king wanted to withdraw his ambassador, the king of Sardinia, the English government told him it couldn't be done. He was too vital for English politics as a go-between between these different factions which dominated England, so that Parliament itself becomes rather unimportant in most of the 18th century, but it is country house politics centering around the great country houses which I have talked about. Whatever we might say about the nobility, it is clear that culturally they still set the standard. They still provided patronage for the most important artists and writers, which in France, remember, became extremely sophisticated indeed. But they still provided the great patronage for artists and writers. Indeed, the cultural nexus shifts only very slowly. And it isn't really until the 19th century that the middle classes become the great patrons of art, literature, and music. And we shall see in a minute how this came about. But in the 18th century, you still have a continuation in most of Europe of noble patronage, which was fairly sophisticated. In the library of the great nobles, you find indeed most of the cultural heritage of Europe. A great many important books, a great many important cultural facets were done this way. We must ask ourselves, finally, what about changes in the way of life? Something you're very fond of, I know. So I try to oblige. Here are two things to notice. First, the greater luxury combined with greater comfort. I've made this clear already. The countryside was safe, the towns were safe. You get the country house, but also the townhouse. What it did not mean as yet, however, as you're always so interested in that, was better sanitation. We have a German doctoral thesis which comes to this conclusion, that Munich, a town of 40,000, by mid-18th century only had 130 bathtubs. Showers were unknown. But this kind of idea of cleanliness and evil you can still see in 1780 when the Protestant consistory of Leipzig questioned the qualification of a candidate for the ministry on grounds that he took baths too often. What you have are public bathhouses for which it cost bath money. And bath money was part of the regular wages in our period of most domestic servants or others, but baths were not taken more than once a month. Though it must be said, on the other hand, there are already signs of the future. Empress Maria Theresa became anxious when she heard that her daughter Marie Antoinette never brushed her teeth. You can imagine what she must have smelled if she breathed on the hangman. Jesus. Because she never did. This is what one often forgets. However, we can summarize that. We can summarize this from one man who wrote the following in 1783, which gives you a good idea of the non-advance or small advance of this kind of thing. We are content every year to wash our hands, face, and take a few foot baths and go around with a skin which resembles the Swiss Alps in winter. Underneath the snow, there are years of accumulation of dirt. The snow was the perfume, as you know, which they used to overcome the noxious smells, as I'm sure many of you use it today, I'm suspicious. So what you have, therefore, well, that's the only good of perfume, you know. That's how it started. However that might be, the importance of this is that lack of sanitation means, of course, a very large death rate, and means, of course, still a rather short lifespan, about 31 years, a rather short lifespan and a rapid death rate. But together with the growing luxury, which does then not mean growing sanitation, secondly, and perhaps even more important, life was becoming more public. for two institutions of some importance see their rise in the late 17th, early 18th century, two institutions which will have political importance. The coffee house in Central and Western Europe, and the club above all, everywhere, but above all in England. The coffee house's origin is very simple. Coffee was regarded when it was introduced in the 17th century like an alcoholic drink. That is to say, for example, Voltaire used to get drunk on coffee. And as, well, you know, coffee, whiskey, marijuana, what next? I mean, you know, drunk on a lot of things. It's a progression. So that what you have is getting drunk on coffee, therefore. I'm not passing a value judgment, you know. I just feel pity for people who have to escape into a dream world. So that what you have, therefore, that's good. One has to inject a note of morality. I always have to lecture on such immoral things. However, the coffee house was started for a very good reason. It was started because that drink wasn't respectable at home. And so you get the growth of a coffee houses in England and the continent, which came to be places where newspapers and other things lay out, and still more important, places of male gathering. Because you can imagine that for a female it wasn't proper to drink such alcoholic beverages. So that what you have, as they became places for male gatherings, they also became places for discussion of politics, for that is what males would discuss, among other things, when they were among themselves. So that the coffee house grew up as a political institution, as an institution of public debate and public forum, which it will remain in much of Europe, at least until the Second World War. In England, things were slightly different. For one thing, coffee houses go best if you also have tables outside, and the English climate, of course, won't allow this. In England, instead, the club grew up. First, what were these clubs? They had a direct connection with the Enlightenment. Many of these clubs started as literary societies where one could improve one's mind, where people, again men of course, met together to improve their minds and read the newest thing of the presses as far as the Enlightenment was concerned. Again, of course, not thought fit for female ears. But from that they became places where there was dancing and card playing. Dancing and card playing were the chief amusements of the 18th century, anyhow. And from then on, they began to diverge. The clubs, like the coffee houses, being largely gatherings of males, become more and more political clubs. And eventually, until this day, they take on political names. The Reform Club, for example. The Liberal Club. Or, still, one of the more best clubs of London, which you've seen, you see all these clubs when you go down to Piccadilly on the right, they're all together more or less. The Athenaeum, the great club which came out of a literary society and is today mainly frequented by bishops and academics. But what you have here, therefore, is the beginning of the system of clubs. And in England, they were to be the great forums of public discussion. And in a way, the great forums for the building of political alliances and political parties, and will of course remain so to this day in England. The literary societies, however, will also continue as the instrument of culture. They will continue in a different way. They will become what we call the salons. That is to say, they will gradually tend from the nobility to the middle classes as extremely able and females with artistic taste would found a salon, which you would call, I suppose, a weekly at home. A weekly at home where the writers and artists would gather to discuss the newest literature, but eventually to discuss any kind of cultural topic. By the beginning of the 19th century, the salons became the great vessels of cultural transmission and the great vessels for the newest in literature and art, which by that time was no longer the Enlightenment, but was, of course, Romanticism. You have, therefore, the beginning of the great salons. And the thing about them is they are no longer noble. They are now middle-class lady. Henrietta Hertz in Germany and others, Madame Taylor in England, in France, Madame Taylor in France, literary salons. So that the clubs go one way and the literary salons go another. These clubs, therefore, then, are important. And you will hear soon about one of the most famous of these political clubs, which happened to be in France and not in England, the Jacobin Club. For the Jacobin Club, in its origin, was one of those clubs, which started out also as a kind of literary society and became more and more political as a political male kind of a gathering. All this is important because it means a diffusion of the interests in politics. It means that the active interest in politics gets a broader and broader base as it gets more and more public institutions, then above all the coffee house and above all the club. Moreover, the club and the coffee house became to a certain extent a mixing place between the upper classes, middle classes and nobility mixed at the English clubs and at the continental coffee houses. For they were identified with politics, with a political movement, or perhaps with a literary movement. You know already, if you know anything about modern literature in the 20th century, that all these figures, whether it is Kafka or Brecht or anybody, everybody had his coffee house, where they went, and in fact, where most of modern literature was actually written, on the tables in the coffee houses. But from our important beginning, it diffuses politics and it mixes the classes, both the clubs and the coffee houses. Not the lower classes, but, of course, the middle classes and the nobility. We can sum it up, then, this way. That it was an age like all ages, both conservative in the peasant element that gave it stability in the unchanging countryside. There was social mobility side by side with a structured society. The political base was broadening to the clubs and the coffee houses, but it was still, above all, a society of caste. The word caste is a much better word than the word class for our purpose. Because the word caste means that there can be a certain amount of mobility, but that it is a matter of inheritance, that it is still a matter of inheritance. Because a caste you're born into, a class you can usually rise into or rise out of, but a caste you're born into, and there you remain. So it is really what we would call still a caste society. And it is, I think, a much more useful word for us than the word of class, which is generally at times misleading. Finally, at the same time, and on this I can unfortunately only hint, at this same time you get, on top of all this, what we might call a general change in morality. This general change in morality is connected, not with the Enlightenment, about which we have heard so much, but with the evangelical and pietistic movements, about which we have heard much less, but which, as you remember, were going on strong in this kind of dialectic that I have tried to explain to you, that you have the evangelistic movement, this revival of pietism. What it means is a change in manners and morals, which will again be slow at first, but accelerated by the French Revolution, because many people believe that the French Revolution was an act of God to punish a heathen and society and a society which was given to the sins of the flesh. So that this change in manners and morality a change which has produced your manners and your morality, that change came first slowly through the evangelical movement, accelerated by the French Revolution. What can we say about it in general? First of all, it has been called, with some justice, the onslaught of respectability. This is partly to do with the fact also that women were not allowed in coffee houses anymore, and that women were not allowed in clubs. Because while before the 18th century, the bawdy wench was not a matter of opprobrium, it wasn't used as opprobrium, after the middle of the century, the bawdy wench would be a term of opprobrium. Together with that, you have, of course, then a different view of women. Respectable, sheltered. And already, in a way, you might call it a decline from your point of view, that woman must be sheltered, and that the main thing about woman is her emotions rather than doing man's work. You have, secondly, with this change, of course, a respectability that pervades every part now of the upper social spectrum. But what comes to the nobility of the bourgeoisie is imitated by the lower classes. So it soon comes to pervade all the spectrum. You get the beginning of these ideas of shame about nudity, about which there was very little shame in the 17th and 18th century. The shame about sex, about which there's very little shame in the 17th and 18th century. Little children were immediately educated in sex. There was very little shame, but this all now changes. There is now a great shame in the lust of sin. And that, of course, comes partly from the evangelical movement and partly from this matter of the French Revolution. You get now the expurgated editions of Shakespeare, for example, and of many other 16th century writers. I don't think I have to dwell on that at great length. You all have an image of your mind of what respectability is, and I'm sure it is the right kind of image. So what you have then here is this change which came within one generation. And just to make that plain for a minute, there are several stories that can be told. Sir Walter Scott, for example, got some books for his mother, for an old aunt, in the 1780s. And he asked her about 20 years later, when she was very aged, what did you do with the books? She said, I burnt them. They were not fit reading. But in the 1780s, she had read them with a great deal of pleasure. Or a woman who sat next to the German poet von Brentano, one of the great romantic figures, and said, von Brentano, I liked your early productions, which would have been in the 1780s. And this encounter took place about 1810. And Brentano said to her, you should be ashamed as a wife and a mother to read such things. It was, I think, very rapid, and it founded what we call modern respectability, which went hand in hand with modern good manners. With modern good manners, whatever you think about is totally beside the point. It happened. With modern good manners, it went hand in hand with modern good manners to produce, actually, modern man and modern woman to get away even further from the primitivism, if you like, of early modern Europe. Though you may not think this sort of primitive, but all I can say here is what would happen if I went to one of your dinner parties and did what was au courant in the 18th century, namely put my hand and fondled your breasts. What would happen? If I hadn't done that in 1880, I would never be invited again, because it was an insult to my hostess. But if I did it today, well, I might become a culture hero. I don't know. Whatever happened. I don't intend to do it, however. However that might be. Now, of course, it was the French Revolution which shook up this society, as I did almost every phase of European life. And it is to the French Revolution itself that we must come on Wednesday. And now, as usually, I'll pause for any questions you have. But I tell you, if there are mass exoduses, I shall not pause for questions anymore. Nor do I want to keep you. I mean, these are for you. They've gone quite well, I have a feeling.